the racing capital of the world. This is the talk of Gasoline Alley.
For Alanzer, winner of the...
Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice.
Scott wins it! I lost the 1/10 of a second!
Now, here's the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee.
To the talk of Gasoline Alley, I'm Kurt Cabot from the Indianapolis Star, filling in for Kevin Lee, who is on basketball duty. And the one we can't replace, Donald Davidson, is here tonight. Welcome, Donald. Good to see you.
How are you?
Good. It's a couple days of non-track activity. But there's still plenty of history to talk about.
I went to the fastest rookie luncheon today.
And?
It was Joseph Newgarden.
We had this conversation last night on Trackside and then again on the talk of Gasoline Alley to some extent about who should have been the rookie labeled the fastest. Was there anybody else from old time's sake joining us today?
Oh, old time's sake?
Yeah.
Every rookie was there except Rubens Barrichello had a conflict. He was there earlier. He actually showed up, did some interviews, and then he had to leave. But all of the others were there. And I met Jean Alise. I was placed at his table, and he is a delight. And I had not met him before. And so he got up, and he went around the table to shake everybody's hand, because what they do is they place a rookie at a table where they probably don't know anybody except for maybe if they have a handler. And there's people with the milk industry Newgarden and his mother sat with the mayor, and so they try and put a driver at each table. They succeed in putting a driver at each table. So I don't think he knew anybody else, but he had charming conversation with the lady next to him and talking across the table. And then when we did the toast of milk at the end, which is traditional, and he not only clinked the glass with either people on either side, but he actually got up and went around the table and clinked the glass with everybody. And I thought, that is just such class, and especially with the type of month that he's having and the decision coming down that they do not get the extra horsepower. So here's this world-class driver. I think he won 8 Grand Prix, drove for Ferrari, so he's enjoyed the best of the best, and yet he's like Michele Alboreto. He's just a very nice guy. And the fact that he's going to start the race dead last, and probably be dead last, and yet he was just could not have been more charming.
Let me continue this. I'll introduce myself as caller Kurt on line one.
Yes, Kurt. Good evening.
Thanks for joining the show. I appreciate you having me. There was this is a very Formula One heavy field.
Yes,
and I would assume this is probably about as rich with Formula One history, with Barrichello and Sato and Jean Alesi and somebody else.
Funny you would Justin Wilson.
Justin Wilson.
Yeah. Funny you would ask, because this question came up and I started digging around and I had one that really surprised me. So I don't have the answer on number of starts, but I know that Barrichello has 300 and something.
Right.
And Alesi has just over
200.
It's like 201 or something like that, I think. And then you've got the others with many fewer, but it adds up. So the question was, is this the most number of Formula One starts? And I thought, well, golly, 67 had Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart, Jochen Rindt, Jim Clark, Dennis Hulme. And Mario Andretti was in the field, but he hadn't had a Formula One start yet.
Can't count that yet.
No. It's because I believe that it has to be how many starts were at the time of that 500. There's a stumper in there. Lloyd Ruby had one. Anyway, so I started looking at others, and I thought, well, maybe 1993 should have a look, because of the fact that you had there was 4 world champions in the 93 race. You had Mario Andretti, ton of starts. Fittipaldi, ton of starts, Nelson Piquet, and Mansell. And, I mean, they all had – because, you know, in the early – if you go to the 50s and 60s, you know, they would have like 7 and 8 Grand Prix a year was the world championship. And now they have, you know, 18, so you can pile them up a lot quicker. But So I thought, well, we've got those four. And then I thought, well, let's look and see who else we have. And I don't think I could do them all. But I came up with 11 people in the 93 500 that that had Formula One experience. You're making notes. Okay, that's all right. No, that's
because
okay.
It's going to come up in the star at some point. Right. I'm going to have to call you back and ask the question off air.
Figured that you were doing. All right, so we've got Mansell, Andretti, Piquet, and
which
one that I missed.
We
had the, see, I didn't need to review this. Now I got myself in a jam. I got Fittipaldi, Andretti,
Piquet and Mansell.
Piquet and Mansell. All right, that's the four world champions. All right, you also have Stefan Johansson and Danny Sullivan had some Grand Prix starts by then.
Cheever.
Excuse me. Cheever had a ton. I think he had 132 or 133. And then there was Raul Boisel had a few. Roberto Guerrero had a few. And I want two more. Oh, Teo Fabi. And I wasn't sure if Fabi had any starts at that time or not. I mean, he drove Formula One, but I'm not sure if he had a Formula One start at that early in the career. And then the other one was Jim Crawford had a handful.
Right.
But, you know, if you add that lot up, it might be more. But I was amazed. And when I started looking at the list, I never would have guessed that there were that many. The four world champions I remember, and then I thought, well, Stefan Johansson, but then all these others started coming up. And so that probably, I suggested that to somebody who I think is probably going to figure it out. And in total number of starts, it might be more than this one.
See, the stuff I can come up with. Actually, I think we were might have even been copied on the same email. So,
oh, my mine was from, was it from BBC?
No, it wasn't the BBC.
Okay. All right.
They call you. They don't call me.
All right, then.
The BBC can't spell my name. So let's get started.
Oh, yeah, the callers. Oh, yeah,
the callers.
Right, sure.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
They actually dialed the number, rotary probably. Let's go to Mike in Vernon Hills, Illinois. Let's. Mike, are you with us this evening?
Hi, Mike.
Yes, guys. How are you, gentlemen?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Not a Formula One driver, but perhaps you can talk about Norm Hall.
Norman Hall? Sure. One of my favorite people. he had two starts, but my contention was always that some of the people with short careers that started in the back had some of the most interesting lives. So Norman Hall, his career at the Speedway was from 1960 as a driver, because he was a crew member before that, being 1960 through 1967 was the last time that he tried to qualify, and he had the two starts, 1961 and 1964. And, golly, I don't know, where shall I go here? Because there's so many Norman Hall stories that I'd like to tell. But he was 10th in 1961. He passed the test in 60 with a car that he bought. This is a whole story right here. He bought a car from J.C. Agajanian. In the winter of 59-60, he'd saved up a little money. He'd been running CRA and he'd run some midgets, and he'd run CRA both in track roadsters and in sprints. And so now he was at the point, and he'd been back to the Midwest. He'd run a few sprint cars, never really had didn't have any top finishes, but he thought, by golly, you know, I want to do this 500. So he purchased the car, and it was the Agajanian Special that was built for Troy Ruttman in 1952. And which had failed to qualify, and it did go to Monza and finished 10th overall there. I think it was 4th in one of the heats, but that's the only day on which it had any success. And then in 59, Chuck Day, the sports car driver, took his rookie test with it, but he couldn't get going in it. And there were several drivers took it out for rides, and then finally Eddie Russo tried to qualify it on the last day and didn't get into the field. So Agajanian had brought it to the Speedway twice. It was a brand new car. Little bit of trivia. When Troy Ruttman ran it in 1958, it was the first car to have onboard jacks for pit stops. The first time they were in the race was actually several cars had them in 1959. It was way before Penske. Penske is to get credit for the onboard air jacks, but it goes back way before him. We're supposed to be talking about Norman Hall, right? Okay.
Usually.
So he goes to, he said, I went to the, He went to pick up the car, and he said Agajanian had it at the dump in Gardena. He was they had the refuse business, the garbage collectors for the city of Gardena, and he said it was actually there was a tarpaulin over it in a little building in the dump. So he said I took the thing, and it was we fixed it up. He said I took it over to A.J. Watson, and Watson would do anything for anybody, and so they prepped it and bought it back. And I know I mentioned the other night that it ran, he took his rookie test, it ran as the Ridgewood Builder Special. And I'd always thought that Ridgewood Builders was a Los Angeles a concern of some kind. It was a tiny little place on 16th Street, just on the other side of the speedway. If you go through the underpass and you come up the hill.
Heading east
from the track, right? And then you go probably a block and a half, and you go by where the little Ridgewood Builders was, and they were home contractors. So anyway, that was the sponsor. He passed the test. Coming down to the final weekend, chief mechanic was Bob Higman, and Higman replaced Norman Hall with Bill Homeyer. And Norman said, "How could that happen? How could I get fired? I own the car." So, anyway, Bill Homeyer went ahead and finished 13th. So Norman comes back the next year, and he drove for Joseph Concannon. This is going to be a two-parter, I rather think, but I'll keep an eye on you, and you can tell me when we need to take the break here. But I don't think we can do this in one segment. So it was the Concannon Car Company Special, and it was a used car dealer, Joseph Concannon. And I think his business, he had two. I think one was on Keystone, and the other one, for a while, was right across from the Speedway. Used car lot. So anyway, and it was the old Anstead Rotary car, so Norman qualified that, but he got bumped. And knowing that that was happening, he went off looking for rides, and in those days, there was always cars available. Drivers and cars were changing all the time. He made a qualifying attempt with the Drury Special, little lightweight car that Chuck Wyant had been trying to get up to qualifying speed. It was Mark Monteith's guest the other day. And then it was the last qualifying day, middle of the afternoon. He'd actually come back to the track on the last day, and the Drury's people hadn't come in yet. And he thought, I can't wait for them. I need to make the show here and something. And he said he'd been struggling all month, and then all of a sudden he took out one of the Federal Engineering Curtis cars, which was several years old, and he said, all of a sudden I got going. And then they had a second car, and he said, I got in that, and he said, I had them both up to speed. So he ended up qualifying at 144 point something, and he started in the last row, but he wasn't, I think he started 31st, but in speed rankings, I think he was like 18th or 20th or something like that. But he ran all day, and he finished 10th. So in his first 500, he did something that many drivers never did. I mean, you know, it took Dick Simon forever to get to 10th. Jim Herdebees never had a top 10 finish. Norman Hall had a top 10 finish. More trivia. At the time, he was roommates with Foyt. Can you believe that? And he said at one point that he said Sachs and Foyt came up on him, and he said, I just stayed in the middle. And they went on either side of me. And he said later, Foyt said, he said, I'm glad that was you because I just figured that you'd stay put where you were. And then a little bit later I know we got to take a break here, but later that summer, Foyt had gone somewhere to a championship race, and he had a Bosiel Fair sprint car that he ran, and he entrusted it to Norman Hall, who took it down to Salem and finished fourth. So there's photographs of this Bosiel Fast number one on the high banks at Salem, and it ain't Foyt. It's Norman Hall. But anyway, there is more to the story, so perhaps we should... I will now turn the duties over to you, and we can help us gracefully exit out of this.
Well, I'm not sure about gracefully, but we do have Donald and Steve and Mark still on the line. Calls as somebody gets off the line, 239-1070 if you're in Indianapolis, 317 the area code. This is a privilege to sit in tonight with Donald Davison and Kurt Cavan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Welcome back to the Talk of Gasoline Alley. This is Kurt Cavan and for Kevin Lee. And Donald, you wanted to finish up with Norm Hall.
Oh, yes. Not quite there yet. So when he finished 10th, he went the full 500 miles and made the champion 100-mile-an-hour club. That he did not make it in 62 or 63. 62, he actually was in a second Dean Van Lines car and had an accident in practice. And then he got into a second Bill Forbes Racing Team special. So he was briefly the teammate of Shorty Templeman. And he went out on the second day was very, very windy. Dave Laycock was the chief mechanic. Very, very windy. And Norman, who always was quite business-minded, suggested, look, let's go out and qualify. And if it's so windy, nobody else is going to, we could get the prize money for the fastest qualifier of the day, which I think was like $1,500 or something like that. Well, he went out. And he never completed a lap. He did the warm-ups, came down for the green flag, and I'll tell this story on him because it was told to me by a couple of fellows that were on the wrecker in turn one, which will kind of illustrate how the response time of the safety crew. And they said that we heard Norman Hall's coming down. The hand is in the air. He's on it. And he said, we heard him come down the straightaway, and then we had the motor running, and we started moving out because we looked at each other and said, he didn't back off. He ain't going to make it. And sure enough, he came squealing through and hit the wall and did actually, I think he broke a collarbone, I think. 63, he struggled with several cars and didn't get in. But in 64, he came back with his own car. He traded a midget, I think, and financial consideration in order to get the constant hot special that Roger McCluskey had driven the year before. And he with a partner named Grover Pope. And they didn't have a sponsor, so it was briefly called the Nothing Special. But he qualified. It was a beautiful paint job, one of my favorite paint jobs of all time. In fact, it was one of the first two or three cars that I actually saw run at the track, like a beautiful turquoise with red and white trim. So anyway, he qualified for the last row. In fact, I think he was the 31st. I think he started 31st both times. I never thought about that. But anyway, he actually had an engine problem, and AJ Watson said, now this is technical, so I may have this wrong. He said he went over to Watson's house on Crawfordsville Road and got a sprint car block, which was, instead of a 255 offy, this was for a 220. And I think he put that block to qualify. And if I'm saying something there incorrectly, then forgive me, because as I've said many times, I ain't a gearhead. Well, then they didn't have a sponsor, but they got one. George Hurst of Hurst Floor Shift had sponsored the Bobby Johns Smoky Eunuch sidecar, which hadn't made it. And they wanted to have a car in the race. So one thing led to another, and George Hurst proposed a deal that Norm would run the rest of the championship trail and get an amount for calling the car the Hurst Floor Shift Special at each race. And I think it was like $100 a race or $150 a race. It was a little different back then. So he qualified for the 500, and I remember that he said, and Norman Hall, Watson said, look, you don't know what the attrition rate's going to be like. You made the show. Why don't you just take the green flag and come in at the end of the first lap and take 33rd, and you can save yourself some wear and tear. Well, that would have been good advice, because he didn't come in at the end of the first lap, and at the end of the second lap, he got caught up in the Sachs McDonald accident. So he wasn't injured, but he did, you know, damage the car and sort of bouncing off the wall to get stopped. So he got 33rd. Anyway, so for the rest of the summer now, there was a man named Harlan Fike, and Parnelli Jones fans will know who that is, Fike's Plumbing sprint car. Well, he also had a championship, what we now call a championship dirt car. So Norm Hall made a deal to lease that car, and it was a Chevy. And the idea was that he would run that in the dirt races, and then he would run the Watson Roadster that they had in the paved races. Well, they went to the first, I think they went to Langhorne. They went to Milwaukee. They went to Langhorne. It might have been a race at Trenton, and then there was Springfield and Milwaukee weekend, and he went to Springfield, and he blew an engine in practice. So he would have missed the show on that. And then he went to Harlan Fike, and Fike said, look, I don't want to spend any more money on this. But if you want to take the car and run the rest of the year, if you want to make a deal to get an engine, that's up to you. So anyway, what they did for the rest of the year was he had the dirt car and he had the Roadster and they had one engine and they finished the season and they would switch the engine back and forth. And there was something about they had to turn the exhaust around the other way. And the plan got stymied a little bit when the Hoosier 100 got rained out on a Saturday, and they postponed it to the following Saturday, which was the day before a race at Trenton, a 200-mile race. And so he thought, all right, now I'm stuck. What am I going to do? So he made an arrangement with A.J. Watson, and I think they took the engine out of the Roadster and put it in the dirt car because they figured we don't need so much power on dirt. And I will put the engine that Watson's loaning me and stick it in the Roadster. And then somebody can tow it over to Trenton because they're going to fly us after the Hoosier 100. So they did that. And I think he was fifth at the Trenton 200. Anyway, I think he had two fifths in 200-mile races at a time when points were paid according to the distance of the race. And he finished just about every race. He was eighth and ninth and tenth and occasionally fifth. And he ended up eighth in the 1964 National Championship. And he said he made a profit. But he did it with two cars and one engine. Next year he came back with the car. He qualified. He got bumped. And then that July he was running at Raceway Park on part of the road course. What is referred to as the first USAC Championship road race. Actually, they only used a portion of the road course out at Raceway Park. But anyway, going down what was the backstretch on this particular day, he flipped, and it's pretty hard to flip a Watson Roadster, but he did it, and he ended up, he had to have a foot amputated. So he tried to drive after that a little bit, but 1967 was the last time. And he was a car owner. He actually owned the last car that Jim Herdebees ever tried to make a qualifying attempt with. It was an Eagle with a stock block Chevy in 1981. But there's a little personal note about him. Well, actually two. Marie Hall, in fact, I talked to her today. She ran the shop, the business that they started together on the corner of 16th and Lyndhurst. And which was a great hangout for races, but this is information for those people who may not necessarily be a racing enthusiast, and if they're not, then they probably tuned out of this thing a long time ago. But if they're interested in early aviation, this has surprised a lot of people. World War One. There was a unit, the Lafayette Escadrille. Which is Escadrille, and that was the famous one that there's been all kinds of books written about it, and it was a mixture of French and American pilots who fought in World War One. And it was one of those things where, you know, everybody thinks that their relative drove in the 500. Well, a lot of people think that their relative flew in the Lafayette Escadrille. Well, actually, only a few people did. It could be other escadrilles. But the seven founders, one of them was the infamous Weston Burt Hall, and that's Norman Hall's dad. And so I knew about that, and he was a bit of a rogue and got thrown out of the Lafayette quite early. And when I first approached Norman about it, he was very easy, willing to talk about it and told me all kinds of stories. And in fact, he talked about different people that he had met when he was a boy. He met the famous German pilot named Ernst Udet. I'll be in just a moment here. And Ernst Udet was famous for World War One for being very sporting about flying, and that he would shoot somebody down, but he would do it in such a way that they wouldn't have a terrible accident, and then he would go to the hospital to see if they were okay. And then the final little bit of trivia, there's all kinds of stuff about Norman Hall, very, very colorful life. When he was a boy, because his dad was involved in the movie industry for a while, he actually did a screen test for a Shirley Temple movie called The Stowaway, I think, and he didn't get the part, but he said, He told me, long deceased now, but he said, somewhere in the MGM vault, there's a screen test of me when I was, you know, when he was like 8, 9 years old. Anyway, great guy. And thank you, Mike, for asking about it. And as we go into the second half hour here, maybe we'll take a second phone call.
There's no follow-up for that one, okay. So we'll just segue into the commercial break. Donald, you'll be next, and this is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Welcome back to the Talk of Gasoline Alley. It's Kurt Cavan sitting alongside Donald Davidson, and we'll move into caller number two of the program.
I hope that's okay.
This is a sign of the evening, I think.
All right, we'll pick it up.
We'll move to Donald in Richmond. Donald,
maybe we won't pick it up. Hi, Donald.
Hi, Kurt. Donald, I recently came across a photograph of Lee Waller that was taken in 1951, and he was wearing a shirt that had embroidered on it 135 miles per hour club. Could you tell us about that club?
Yes, it didn't last very long. There was the champion 100 mile an hour club was the survivor, but in 1951 there were a few drivers that qualified at 135 miles an hour. It was a qualification thing. And a fellow named Roger Foster, who was on the tech committee for years, had these shirts made up. And, in fact, they called it the 135-mile-an-hour Tramp Club. And they actually gave them a pole with a little bag with they gave them some goodies, but it was put in a bag that would tie on the end of a pole that you'd put over your arm, so just like a tramp. And so Duke Nalen, I don't know if I can remember everybody, there was Duke Nalen, Chet Miller, Lee Waller, Jack McGrath, Fred Agabashian, and then the surprise was Carl Scarborough. Now, I think there might have been 7. Anyway, they had a little dinner with a handful of people. The drivers were all there and the wives. Because things were different in those days. Or if there was a meal involved, the drivers would go. And so then they did. They had it the next year, and there was a few more people. But that was the end of it. It didn't make it to 53 because the speeds went up to the point where it was taking 135 miles an hour to make the show. But it was just a fun little thing.
Thanks, Donald.
Okay, Donald. Thanks.
We're going to move into Indianapolis. Bring in Steve to the program. Steve, are you with us?
Sure am.
Good. Fire away.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
I want to ask you, how long was Pat Patrick affiliated with the Speedway and his relationship with John Cock, and is he still with us?
Okay, he is still with us. His career was sort of on again, off again, and in fact, I think we mentioned it in, we were talking about something else the other night, and this came in. His original involvement, and I wouldn't even know the first year because there was a family called Michener, Andy Michener's people. There was Joe and Walter, and they had the Michener Petroleum Company, and there was also the Patrick Petroleum Company, and the Michener's ran for the first time in 1966, and whether Patrick was a partner, I don't know that early. But in about 67, he started to have more and more of a presence. And I think they were all Wildcatters, I believe. And at some point, you've got the Michener car is called the Patrick Petroleum Special, but it wasn't owned by Patrick. And that would be in 69 and then 70 when Johnny Rutherford was on the front row. That was the Patrick Petroleum Special, but it was still the Michener's, I think, were the prime owners. So somewhere around maybe 71 or 72, then there was a transition made, and I think probably in 72, Patrick was probably the owner, and Johnny Rutherford, Mike Devon was the mechanic, and then at the end of that year, then they completely redid the team, and then it was what... some people were calling it like a super team, and they hired George Big Daddy for the chief mechanic. They got Eagles, and the team was supposed to be Gary Battenhausen and Swede Savage. Patrick really liked Swede Savage, so it was kind of built around him, but Gary, you know, I don't know whether he would say that he would be the number one driver or not. Well, it ended up that it wasn't Gary because he had run the 72 season for Roger Penske, and it had been, maybe not the smoothest. You know, Gary in those days, he hadn't got hurt badly yet. And so he was pretty feisty, and so he wanted to continue running sprint cars. Patrick didn't want him to, and in fact, at Toledo in 1972, this is a little trivia, at Toledo, Ohio, the night before the Milwaukee 200, he crashed and was injured and couldn't run Milwaukee. And then there's a trivia question, who drove for Gary Battenhausen in the Milwaukee 200 the next day? It's the only Penske start he ever had. So I'll let you think about that one, and then we'll come back and remind me to give the answer on that one. So anyway, at the end of the year, then Battenhausen thinks, well, I'm going to be out at Penske's anyway, and Bignotti wants me to drive for them, so that's great. So he said, yes, we'll do it. Well, then Penske said, oh, no, we signed you to a three-year contract, and we want 3 years out of you. So he had to go back to Bignotti and say, I'm sorry, but I can't do it. So in the meantime, Gordon Johncock had run, I think, like a half a dozen races for McLaren, and they didn't run the whole season, but he was Peter Revson's teammate, a little trivia, Gordon Johncock and Peter Revson together. So at the end of the year, Johncock got pink-slipped. So Gary Battenhausen goes to the Holiday Inn Northwest, which was fairly new at that time, and he runs into Johncock. And he says, oh, you know, but what's up? And so Gary said, oh, well, I was going to drive for Patrick and Bignotti, but I can't because Penske wants me to stay with them. So Johncock's been pink-slipped by McLaren, so the next morning he goes over to Patrick and gets the ride. And then, of course, Johncock wins the 500. And by the way, that's the answer to the trivia question. He was the substitute for Penske. But anyway, I'm telling anecdotes here. Patrick, of course, then went all the way through until, golly, how late did they go? 85, 86, 80, because they had Johncock for years. They had Emerson Fittipaldi. They won the race. Okay, it would be 89, because in 1989, when they won with Fittipaldi, Chip Ganassi had become partners, and then at the end of the year, Ganassi just took the thing over. So Patrick was out of it for a while, and then when he came back in 95 when Firestone came back in, so he had Scott Pruett, and they weren't too far off from winning that one. But anyway, he won it in 73 with Johncock in the rain. The 72 close finish, or sorry, the 82 close finish, he won with Johncock, and then 89 with Fittipaldi. So then he stayed in it for a little while longer. They had Aureo Servia, I think, was the last driver that they had, but he is still around.
Very good. Let's take a break. We've got Mark up next, and Eric, and then we'll try to get to Mike here in our final segment. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
The Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee, 1070 The Fan.
Welcome back to the Talk of Gasoline Alley. In place of Kevin Lee, I'm Kurt Cavan, sitting alongside Donald Davidson, and we'll roll through as many as we can get to here in the final segment. Let's go to Mark in Indianapolis. Mark, are you with us tonight?
Yeah, how you doing, guys?
Good, Mark.
Hey, quick question. What driver holds the record for the four most consecutive qualification laps?
Consistent, I think.
Consistent.
All right. It for a while it was George Snyder, and then I think Bobby Rahal in terms of time, and then I'm not too sure if somebody hasn't beaten that now that they can go to four decimal places. I do remember that back in the two decimal days, that Snyder, I think, had like 55.55 on three of the laps and 55.54 on one. But now they've gone to a third and a fourth decimal, so I'm not sure who that is right now. I think Rahal beat Snyder's. I'm repeating what I said here, and then I'm not too sure that somebody hasn't done a better one since. So, sorry, Jimmy Vassar, maybe? I don't know.
Thanks, Mark. Let's move into Seymour down south for Eric. Are you with us tonight, Eric?
Hi, Eric.
Yeah. Hi. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Don.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I got a question about the 1960 Indy 500.
Yes.
I've read Smokey Unick's book.
He was not the chief mechanic. It was Chickie Hiroshima. Yeah.
Okay.
That comes up from time to time. No, that is totally unfair, and he said some very unkind things about Jim Rathman. It's too bad. Chickie Hiroshima was not only the chief mechanic, he worked with Rathman in the spring. They went out to get the car together and towed it back. And there's also photographs. It's written on the side. You look at the day after photos. It's painted on the side, chief mechanic Chickie Hiroshima. There's also shots posed with Jim Rathman and Chickie and nobody else in the shot. What happened with Smokey was, and I knew Smokey Unick, and I'm very sorry that he said such unkind things about Jim Rathman. The thinking was that Chickie could get a little jittery, and that they didn't want him over the wall. He prepared engines. He was a great mechanic, but he would get very excited. So they thought they needed something cool and calm to run the pits. And so Smokey Unick was hired to sort of be the pit supervisor. And I think he changed the left rear. He may even have been the refueler. But what's interesting is that they actually came to the track with no crew. There's just chief mechanic and no crew, and they picked up a crew after qualifications were over, and they used people that had missed the show. And if believe it or not, they had Bruce Crower of Crower Cams, who was the chief mechanic on a car that didn't make it. I think he did the left front. Ronnie Kaplan, who was an old midget driver who was a crew chief on a car that missed the show, he worked on the crew. And then Al Keller, the driver, who was driving the car that Bruce Carr, you know, that they'd missed the show together. Al Keller worked on the crew. Now, when's the last time that a 500 driver missed the show and then got a job changing a wheel on race day? But anyway, the next year, Smokey, when this relationship faded, it was not immediate because Smokey was the chief mechanic for Jim Rathman the next year. He was the chief mechanic in 61, but not in 60.
Did that answer your question, Eric?
Sure did. I appreciate it.
All
thank
right.
You guys.
Thank you.
Final caller of the night because we're into the two-minute warning. it's basketball time in Indiana. Mike from Mooresville. Mike, fire away.
Hi, guys. This is a pleasure talking to you. When I was younger, I remember Eddie Sachs marching behind a band.
Yes.
And I couldn't remember what band that was.
Oh, I think it probably Purdue. I think that was the morning of the 1963 race.
Okay. Was that the same year that him and McDonald got tangled up?
No, that was 64.
Okay.
63 is when that happened. Yeah, I think it was Purdue went by, and then he just went in and marched behind them.
I would think that's probably the only time that's ever been done.
Probably, yes, with a driver, yes.
Okay, well, I really appreciate it. And, Donald, I talked to you a long time ago about my grandpa being on the Cummins pit crew.
Yes.
And you said, no, it was probably he was a... an honorary member, and you were right. I did talk to somebody who said it was on the Cummins car, and his name was Pulliam, and you were right, though. You were absolutely right.
All right, well, thank you. I know Thane Hauser was an old riding mechanic that was on that crew, and Neville Reniers was the chief mechanic, but the whole crew were all, well, they were all Cummins engineers.
Thanks, Mike. We've got a busy week coming up this week. We've still got Community Day tomorrow. We've got the Indy Lights cars on the track on Thursday, and of course, Carb Day. What are the things there is? I know the race is a little bit later in the weekend.
Well, okay, but we do have some activities, and for race fans, and we will leak the details to you, but there's going to be an autograph session of 500 winners in the museum at 10 o'clock on Friday. And I think we've got 8 that are going to come and sign autographs. And then there's the memorabilia show the day before and the auctioning off of the Henry Banks collection. We're going to do the autograph session in the afternoon. It will be in two phases. So we're going to have groups A and B, and we're going to start at 1. We're going to do 1 to 2:30, and then we'll do another one with different drivers from 3 to 4:30. And there could be some winners involved in that one as well. In fact, we've got 4 who have said they will do it. A little tenuous about that because of the fact that other things come up, and we don't want to have somebody come out and be mad because so-and-so was supposed to be there and they weren't. And then as far as the returning veterans, I think we're probably going to have about 50 that will split into two groups. And then race morning, I'll start putting it out now. Get there in plenty of time. At 20, there's going to be stuff going on all morning, and there is going to be the parade of pace cars bearing 500 winners. It won't be as many as last year, but we'll probably have maybe eight or nine we're thinking at. And then there will be some iconic winning race cars that are going out to be driven by iconic drivers. And I'll give you the list tomorrow.
It's a wonderful week. We treasure the days that lead up to the Indy 500 in addition to the race itself. 96 years of staging this event, and just seems like there's only been that many days this month. It seems like we've had perfect weather and lots of cars on the track and lots of activities and lots of talk of gasoline alleys and trackside with Kevin and Kevin. We'll be back for all of this again tomorrow night. 7 o'clock is tip time for the trackside with Kevin and Kevin. Kevin Lee will join me for that, and then I'll be back with the talk of gasoline alley with Donald Davidson. Donald, thanks a lot. We'll see you tomorrow night.
So Mike King's next with Indy Life.
Mike King is next. Stay tuned. This is 1070 The Fan. Thanks for joining us.